welcome to Searching for Mana, the podcast that investigates the mana. That's the superpower in some of the most influential leaders who are building the future in tech innovation and finance. I'm Lloyd Whitehead, a London-born entrepreneur and headhunter with over 15 years' experience on a mission to discover what drives our guests to succeed. How have they got to the top? What attributes have excelled in their career? Listen to find out. Welcome to Searching for Mana. Welcome on to Searching for Mana, Andrew.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Pleasure to have you on the show. For a fuller introduction, we have this week Andrew D'Souza on the show, who in 2015 founded ClearBank, with another co-founder and a few founders, which we'll go into. Now, in 2021, known as ClearCo. And we'll talk about the rebranding, but really successful journey. And in brief, they've raised somewhere around several hundred million dollars. The business is providing capital solutions for e-commerce, mobile apps, SaaS founders, and many, many more things. Just so that I don't do a bad job of that, Andrew, perhaps you could be so kind to start explaining to us, you know, what ClearCo today do and provide, please.
Yeah, so we've always wanted to be a partner for online entrepreneurs. If you're selling a product online, if you are selling a service online to a consumer or a business, we'd like to partner with you. We started by funding, by providing non-dilutive capital and funding people on a revenue share basis. We kind of pioneered that in the space 5 years ago. And now we do much more than that. We really try and be an advisor and a partner, almost like a you know, coach or board member as well, but digitally and without the governance and things that a VC has. And, you know, so it's really about being, you know, giving you everything you need to succeed as a founder. Our mission has been to help founders win. And we think that as an online entrepreneur, the odds are stacked against you, and we can help shift the balance of power a little bit.
Thank you. So just to dig into that a layer further, could you explain technically the difference between how a traditional venture capitalist would operate and how ClearCo and you guys operate, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think about the spectrum of the types of capital that you could use to fund your business, you've got one end of the, there's a spectrum of risk and cost. On one end of the spectrum, you've got equity and venture capital, and you basically sell a piece of your company to a VC, and you can use that capital however you want. You've offloaded some risk to the VC, but they take ownership and control, you know, piece of ownership and control and governance of your business that you really never get back if they don't want to give it back to you. And so it ends up being very expensive if you're successful. But you've offloaded some risk. On the other end of the spectrum, you've got debt, which you could go to a bank for and say, you know, I'm going to mortgage, you know, something. And, you know, if I've got an asset, I can draw down debt to fund my business. And that adds leverage, just like it would with a stock portfolio or a home or something or building. But it's very low cost if you have assets that you are willing to do that. Now, most banks will have a personal guarantee associated with it because for online businesses, you don't have many other assets in the business that a bank can value. And so what we've tried to do at ClearCo is design a product that sits in between equity and debt, which is, you know, we don't, you know, because if you miss a debt payment, they can force you into bankruptcy and default and take your business or your home or whatever. So we say, look, we're not going to do that. We're not going to have a personal guarantee. We're not even going to have a maturity date. We're going to take a revenue share. So instead of us owning a piece of your business forever, like a, you know, an equity investor, we can give you $100,000 or 100,000, you know, pounds or euros in exchange for X percent, 2% of your revenue for 4 years or for until we get 106 back, right? Is the typical structure. And so that's the structure. Our upside is capped, unlike an equity investor. But our downside is not, you know, if your business is struggling, we're in it with you the whole way. And so it's not going to be as cheap as debt because we don't have the option of taking assets. It's not going to be as expensive as equity because we're not taking a portion of your business.
Brilliant and refreshing solution. And no wonder the business has got such great traction because that mid solution's incredibly appealing. How do you, from a risk decision perspective, because I assume this is a really large element of the success of the business and getting that right, how do you operate that? What does that team technically look like? And how are you managing to feel comfortable with the in essence, lending and equity you're providing?
Yeah, it's been a challenge. You know, when we started, we made some bad investments that were painful, and we just continue to invest in machine learning and focusing on it. I think we realized that there was no way for us to scale this or build any sort of business if we had to do human, you know, if humans were involved. That also introduces a level of bias, which we can talk about a little bit, that we've been able to take out by just using data science to make those funding decisions. Our business model, I mean, so one of the things about venture capital is you can have one winner, right? If you invested in Facebook or Coinbase or Airbnb, all the rest of your companies could have failed and you would still have a great returning fund. Our business doesn't work that way. You know, the max that we make is 6%, which means that almost every single one of our companies has to succeed, right? We need, our business model depends on our companies being success, every single one of them being successful. And so the way that this works is when you apply for funding from Clearco, you plug in the apps that you use to run your business, your payment processor, your e-commerce platform, your ad accounts, you know, your banking data. We automatically present an offer. So we say, look, here's how much capital I think you could use. And then we basically build a revenue prediction for the company. We say, look, here's where we think your revenue is going to go if you spend the capital in these areas. One of the other interesting things is that we have focused on funding repeatable growth. And so what we really look for is businesses that have a way to deploy capital in a predictable and repeatable manner. So I'm spending a dollar on marketing, I get $3 out. I'm spending a dollar on inventory, I can sell that inventory at a, you know, 60% margin in 4 months. If you're investing in R&D and product development, then that's actually probably a good use of equity. If you're investing in something with a very long time horizon with a lot of unpredictability, I'm launching a new product, I'm launching a new market, I don't know if it's going to work, that's where you use equity. But if you've figured out part of your business model, that part of your budget, you should fund with something, you know, like Clearco.
Yeah, I went onto the site and just ran through as if I was going to apply myself to see the type of questions. And yeah, some of them were, as you just say, you know, I suppose how popular is the website? So what type of traffic is there? I saw the thought process, which was interesting. Actually, I hadn't come across that type of thought process on an opening page of a company like yours. And so Andrew, what's interesting to me is a few things, but if you'd gone down the venture capital path, let's say you'd picked the same businesses, but you hadn't capped yourself at 6% or whatever it might be around there, then would you have more value now?
You know, I think it's a tough question, right?
I'm sure you don't spend much time thinking about that.
It's funny, you know, when we started the business, we actually almost started a VC firm and then realized that the world didn't need another VC firm. We can talk about that later, but we had some great businesses that we funded from the very, very early days and have created a ton of enterprise value. We've got some companies in our portfolio that'll go public this year. I wonder if we could have, we may not have even been able to invest. Although I think they would have taken our capital if we had wanted to invest equity in those businesses. And I think it was more important for us to go and develop a new way of funding these businesses and help these founders. It's not to say that we will never have an equity product. You know, we may have an equity product, we may have a traditional debt product if people need that. But I think those markets are relatively well served. And so what we're trying to do is come in and say, look, let us help on the area that, let us go create something new rather than be a, you know, me too in a market that's relatively well served already.
Absolutely. And, you know, because you provided a really great solution. And like you say, it might not have been appealing to some of those successful businesses to have relinquished some of their ownership. But also, if you took that classic venture capital perspective where there needs to be one big winner or a couple, then so many businesses hemorrhage along the way. So whether you would have made more because you've caught one or two really massive ones that are IPOing, actually, if you look at the like net outcome and the value that you've provided to the market, then I can only imagine that it's it feels much more full of purpose across the board. Like you said, all of your businesses, you need to make sure are sensibly managed. So there's all good for these different options. I like it all, but great that you provided something that sits in the middle. So that gives us quite a good understanding. I mentioned a couple of numbers at the beginning, but if you could just explain to us where you're at in terms of what series you're at, what type of valuation the business is at the moment, how many people are in this business, just so we get an idea of the actual company and its internal makeup, please.
Yeah, so we funded about $2 billion so far to about 5,000 businesses around the world. Ironically, we just raised our Series C, $100 million from Oak at a $2 billion, around $2 billion valuation. So those numbers are easy to tie. and we're just over 300 people in the company. We will likely double that this year. So we are growing. We're growing quite quickly and hiring around the world. I think, as you mentioned, our mission has always been to help more founders be more successful than they otherwise would have. And that means that, founders across the world, we want to be across Europe this year. But founders across the world who don't have access to capital and don't have access to resources and advice, if we can unlock them, we think we're doing much more good for the world than just being better at picking winners and beating the top Silicon Valley VCs and getting in those deals. Those companies were good. Those companies would have made it anyway. Those products would have existed in the world with or without us. What we want to do is go create the products and fund the entrepreneurs that are solving problems that the VCs can't relate to, right? We've got founders that are building products for, children with autism or with a specific skin condition or diabetics or whatever. And most VCs don't live those problems. And so they don't fund those solutions. But they've got great businesses, and online you can find, many, many customers for even what seems like a niche product. And that's really where we want to help.
Thanks, Andrew. We've got a really healthy audience of entrepreneurs and SME owners in Europe. So you're going to be coming to Europe with a bang imminently. What type of business, if someone's listening, would you be looking at in terms of shape and size and space where they should, certainly check you guys out?
So we talk about it as, online businesses. We started in direct to consumer e-commerce. So, but if you think about the matrix of you're selling a product or a service to a consumer or a business, and it's either a physical product or a digital product or a piece of software. And if you find your customers online, and they pay you online and you deliver your service, through at least an online, or you can deliver your product remotely, we can help you. And so that's e-commerce, software, even wholesale businesses now and mobile apps and games and media, any business where we can sort of see that transaction happening through a payment processor, and we see where you find your customers, we can help. And these businesses range from, our smallest. Well, I'll talk a little bit about Clear Angel, which is a new initiative we're running. But traditionally, it's been $10,000 or euros or pounds, in monthly sales, all the way up to, 20 plus million. Our largest company will do $500 million in sales this year. So we can scale with companies quite a bit.
Okay, that's super useful to know. And you mentioned Clear Angel. So, I saw that on the website as well. What's that initiative?
So we looked at our data earlier this year and realized it's great. We were kind of patting ourselves on the back. Hey, we funded 5,000 businesses. That's fantastic. And then we looked at all the data, all the businesses that we turned down. And, you know, it was close to 50,000 businesses. And we sort of realized, okay, well, what's the reason? And it's because many of them were kind of too new for our data science to pick up the data to build the revenue prediction, right? Or they were too small. They didn't have the transaction volume, but they really needed our help. And so what we did was we designed a program for earlier stage businesses that may not yet have, you know, the business model, or they may not have the unit economics figured out, but they need capital, but they also need some, you know, guidance and coaching. And so we sort of modeled it after, you know, Y Combinator or Techstars accelerator program. We could talk about our experience with Y Combinator too, and, you know, later on, which would be fun. But we modeled it after, after Y Combinator. And, but instead of it being a 3-month sort of intense program, it's a 4-year program. We invest, $10,000 to $25,000 up front. We get a 2% rev share for 4 years. And so instead of us, again, taking equity, 7 or 10% or whatever happens, we just get a revenue share and preserve the optionality for the founder. But then we pair you up with a coach. We give you a set of objectives, you know, weekly goals and targets. We open up our network. We provide advice and benchmarking and tools. And, you know, the response has been unbelievable, and the impact we've been able to have. And so, it really does feel like, and it's interesting. I mean, we've had companies that are doing, you know, millions of dollars in sales, and still, you know, because they don't have that guidance elsewhere and they've bootstrapped the business, they still want to come to us, and we fund them on a similar structure, and we bring them into the cohort and the program. So, very, very excited about, the future of that piece of the business and the impact that it could have.
What have you seen over the last year through the pandemic? As somebody who is, of course, on top of a lot of data and insights for enterprising, innovative, early stage businesses, as trends that you have seen doing really well and trends that you've seen, I suppose, you know, we're probably aware of what hasn't done so well, like the high street, et cetera, but yeah, particularly the question specific, what have you seen do well over this last year? What are you excited about? Albeit a terrible year, Andrew, of course.
Yeah, this is one of the really interesting things. You know, last March, April of 2020, we saw a ton of volatility. So some categories, you know, spiked. Consumables and groceries, things like that spiked. People had to buy, you know, their toiletries and groceries. And businesses with a subscription model and a rebill, you know, did really, really well in those categories. And then we saw things like fashion and beauty, you know, initially tank and then rebound really strongly. We saw automotive, you know, tank and then rebound throughout the year. And so you saw all of these, you saw this massive dispersion. So there's a lot of reports that say e-commerce is up, which, you know, on the whole, it is. But each industry and each business had to navigate its own demand curve and volatility throughout the year. And so for e-commerce founders, I think that's one of the areas that they came to us and said, hey, look, you know, it looks like my, you know, return on ad spend is plummeting. Is that just me or is that my category? And what can I do about it? And we could go in and say, hey, look, it's actually the category, but there are people in this, you know, either in this part of the world or on these channels or platforms that are still, you know, searching for or buying products in fashion. And so you should maybe switch your advertising over there. And so we actually, you know, sitting on the data that we've got, we can actually help sort of provide that guidance to these founders in navigating their business and figuring out how to get through the volatility of the past year.
So I feel like I have a good understanding now of some of the things that you guys have been doing and what you're up to now, in brief, what you're looking forward to in the short term, in the future. Congratulations. It's all so exciting. Did you, we'll go back now for your background, which is equally interesting and makes some sense how you've been so successful doing this. But even so, did 5 years ago when you set this up, or 5-6 years ago, you assume that you'd get to this stage, or is this, you have to pinch yourself, you feel, you know, so lucky that it's happened?
You know, it's funny. I got an email from one of our investors yesterday. We presented at their annual summit, and it still kind of feels like we have a long way to go. You know, it doesn't really feel like we've, you know, it still feels like the beginning of a journey. It's funny, like I tell my team all the time, I'm not very good at looking back down the mountain at sort of how far we've come up and how much struggle. I continue to look up the mountain and how much work we've got to do. How much potential we've got, but also how much work we've got to do in order to really have the impact that we think we can. And so it doesn't feel that different, right? Than it did 5 years ago. It's more people and more resources to go after the opportunity, but we're still, it feels like less than 1% of the way there.
And look, that's the thing I hear from so many successful leaders. Always got to keep looking forward. But it is healthy, of course, to, have the gratitude for where you're at, which absolutely I can see kind of radiating off you anyway. What do you do separate to what's obviously an all-consuming, really busy, exciting business that you founded and run to keep yourself sane, keep yourself, just outside of work, is there some things that you have as interest to balance things out?
Yeah, I mean, I used to, I play a little bit of music. My dad is a great guitarist and musician, so he's taught me a little bit of that. And I used to love to play basketball. Since the pandemic, we don't get a chance to do as many basketball runs, but hopefully now with vaccinations going back up, we'll get a chance to get back on the court and do some of that. I'm a huge, huge sports fan. But in reality, it's just, I try and put myself into a cycle of like, it's basically, can I exercise, eat well, sleep well, and sort of minimize stress, I haven't really gotten in a good sort of meditation pattern, but it's one of my goals. My mom has done a very good job of meditating this year, and so she's trying to get me on this. But I find that probably 50% of my days, I actually get that right. And 50% of my days, I kind of fall off. I have a croissant sitting right beside me that I'm like really trying to not eat.
Eat the croissant, Andrew.
Yeah.
It's like, it's fine.
It's one of those things where I'm like, I'm trying to get, if I find myself like on a positive spiral, then it's easier and easier to keep that going. And I sleep better, and then I exercise and I do that. And if I'm on a negative spiral, then it just continues. So that's one of the things that I try and get myself into a good headspace every day.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading yesterday just about different types of mentalities, and like you say, sometimes it feels like you can go right or you can go left, and it ebbs and flows, and that's life. But the really important thing is just to feel like you have a lightness through it all. So there's always a decision, particularly when you've got such a scale of a business and you feel so responsible, as some people do, to go, okay, what's the hard path? How am I going to go fix this right now? And you can just be in a constant state of stress because it's just going to keep growing forever more, most likely. Or you can look at it as if almost it's a game and that's something that you want to fix, but you're going to enjoy that. And that solution means the system's better, and not stress yourself out about it. And I'm sure you must be able to manage that really well.
I don't know if I manage it really well, but it is, I can totally relate, right? The times when it feels like it's a video game and you're like, hey, I'm going to build this skill. I'm going to try and solve this problem. It's a new puzzle to solve organizationally, strategically, operationally, and then there's times when it's like, I am not equipped to go solve this. I have to go, I have to phone a friend, like ask for help, hire somebody that has done it before. Because you're right. I mean, the chaos in trying to grow and scale a business only compounds, and we're all human beings. And so trying to, you often find yourself a little bit overwhelmed. I often find myself overwhelmed with the magnitude of the challenges. But I think it's been, when I can look at those as fun sort of puzzles to solve instead of massive weights on my shoulder, I tend to operate a little bit better.
Yeah, and you've got successful co-founders in your business. Has that been a, I know that you said we'll talk about Y Combi. We'll go into that if you don't mind when we go through your bio. But just last question on that point, and now I raise Y Combi because they almost force that you have to have founders. The belief mechanism is a few things, and one is that for sure it's better to have them. I know the answer is going to be you massively think it's better to have had them. On that particular point where sometimes something might feel out of your capabilities or stressed. Have you found that particularly useful?
You know, it's interesting. I think for me and all my co-founders, this is the biggest business we've ever built. And so we're, you know, I think it's helpful from a emotional support perspective to commiserate and say, hey, look, this is a really tough challenge. And, you know, how are we going to solve it? And from a brainstorming standpoint, but we're also at the point where we know we need to go and hire people who've seen the story before in different markets, in different geographies, at different scales with different perspectives. And so, you know, it's as helpful as it is in those moments to have co-founders so you don't feel completely alone in the abyss. We also recognize that, you know, some of these challenges are outside of our domain of expertise, and we need to go and build out a leadership team that that can bring that to bear.
Thank you, Andrew. So if we go back now to really the earliest moment that you can recall thinking about visualizing what Andrew D'Souza might do for a career. Can you remember?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I was born in India. My mom was born in Kenya. But I'm from a place called Goa. It's like a Portuguese colony in India. And my dad had an opportunity to move to the US when I was pretty young. And so, you know, they kind of picked up and moved. We got there for a few years. He couldn't get a visa to stay. So it was either move back to India or go somewhere else. So we moved to Canada. And so that was sort of just when I started school. And so it's interesting. I always think of my parents as being pretty risk averse people, but in reality, they've, you know, taking this massive risk with really no, you know, plan or savings or job, and figuring out how to make life in a new country with snow and you know, cold, must have been quite terrifying. And so I'm sure, you know, I think many people who are immigrants have this sort of, you know, risk tolerance and DNA in them. I think growing up, I'd always, and it could have just been because, yeah, my parents were as generous as they possibly could have been, without very much means. But I kind of knew from the very early days that if I ever wanted anything beyond sort of the basic needs, I'd have to find a way to earn it myself. And so if I wanted to buy CDs or, you know, go to the movies with my friends or whatever, you know, I'd have to find a way to earn something. And so I started, I started a paper route in, you know, I called the local paper. It was like, you don't deliver to my neighborhood, I'll deliver it for you. And you know, started a bunch of businesses, tutoring kids, walking dogs, you know, babysitting, all of that stuff when I was probably 10 years old. Started to do that stuff. And, you know, I think I'd always been interested in this, but I never thought of myself as like an entrepreneur. I just thought about it like, hey, I've got to earn some money and I can't get a job. Like I can't work at a restaurant when I'm 10. So I'll have to like find a way to get it, you know, some side money. You know, I think I ended up studying engineering at the University of Waterloo in Canada. Always thought I was going to build and design cars. I loved cars in high school. And one of the nice things about that program is it allowed me to try a bunch of different things. They had this co-op program. So every 4 months, you get to try something different. And then you go back to school for 4 months and you work for 4 months. So I got to work in the GM, you know, automotive plant. And that was great. I loved building robots and designing robots and things to manufacture cars. But I also realized that I was never going to be, I didn't want to be a plant manager at, you know, an automotive plant. And you know, that was sort of the career trajectory there. So I tried a few different things, tried strategy consulting, worked at McKinsey for one co-op term. And I thought that was very interesting work because you get to be very strategic, but it lacked the building and accountability of engineering, right? When you build, you know, a piece of software, when you build something, you own it and you deliver it to the world. And if it breaks, it's your responsibility. When you're a strategy consultant, you deliver a recommendation and then the implementation of that recommendation is your client and they really own it, right? If it goes well, you know, it was because they executed on it well. If it goes poorly, you know, it was probably also the same and you don't really have that accountability. And so that was what probably led me to startups was I loved the building side of it, but I also loved the accountability. And it's hard to do both in a big corporation. You're either building or you're driving strategy, but you don't actually have the accountability. And so I met this guy named Chamath, who was a fellow Waterloo graduate, you know, Canadian immigrant, He was probably 10 years ahead of me in school, and he convinced me to move down to Silicon Valley. He was head of growth at Facebook at the time. And so it was either join his team at Facebook, which I think might have been more financially lucrative for me. It was pre-IPO Facebook. But he was like, it might be more fun for you to join. You know, I'm leaving Facebook. I'm starting a fund. I'm on the board of this company called Top Prospect. It was like a recruiting platform. They're looking for their first sort of business person to do sales and marketing and everything. And so I ended up moving down and joining them. And that's how I got plugged into the startup world.
Yeah. So, wow. It's very, it's a very inspiring journey. And you were so cognizant early on of for you, it probably seems simple, but you know, the differentiation of feeling the ownership of a product and wanting to build it, that, you know, that's relatively unique at that type of stage. And then actually, you know, making that type of decision to go do it. Because the reason I say that is we could wash through this part of the career, but you know, I have a immigrant parent as well, right? And you know, understand, you know, if you've done the paper round and you've done work to earn money, if you suddenly are in a place like McKinsey, you could feel like, I mean, this is, I can stay here, right? I mean, the money's going to be better than anything the family potentially's ever had. The lifestyle is going to be what I want it to be to a degree. But actually, you know, your ambition was about the nature of work you're doing and how you felt. And so you went and made the decision to move on. And then the serendipity in the story, and I'm sure it's everywhere in it. The individual that Andrew's talking about, if people don't know, who's very relatively, I'd say very famous now for sure.
Famous, infamous, yeah, but he's known, yeah.
He's a character. You know, as somebody who the audience will know, I read a lot of biographies and I'm just interested in tech and high growth businesses. You know, if you read about the Facebook journey, I mean, he was relatively important at that stage. You know, he's somebody who's attributed to a lot of their growth hacking becoming successful and the business becoming viral. And obviously, like you say, at that stage, there was very lucrative opportunities. But of course, you know, it's become a really famous investor since, and maybe a social media celebrity, we could say as well. So you went and worked with him. And at that point, what were you guys, what was the thesis? What were you looking to invest in?
Yeah, so I actually ended up joining one of his companies. It was funny, you mentioned the McKinsey thing. My mom cried when I left McKinsey. She wanted me to have the Harvard MBA and come back to McKinsey and do my career there. She wanted to tell all her friends that son was a partner at McKinsey or whatever. So I pulled the ripcord on that journey pretty early, and she had no idea why. I still think she doesn't understand. She still kind of wants me to go back and do that, and put something on the wall. So Chamath had invested in this company called Top Prospect. And the idea was we're gonna build a recruiting referral network on top of LinkedIn and Facebook in the early days. So, you know, people were paying for, you know, paying headhunters and recruiters to go and find people. And they said, look, some of the best talent comes from referrals. What if we just pay the people that send us referrals? And many companies had introduced internal referral programs. We had sort of externalized them. And we sort of said, look, anybody, it doesn't matter whether you work here or not, you know, you refer me an engineer that I hire, I'll pay you $5,000, $10,000. And so really interesting product. I'd always been really interested in sort of careers and recruitment anyway. And so my job was to get companies on board to post their jobs and post the referral bonuses. And we had this in, you know, this, so Chamath was on our board, we had a CEO that he had hired, and you know, it was kind of Chamath's brainchild, but we had this launch date. I remember this vividly because I moved down, and this was my first brush with the American healthcare system. I was playing soccer, football I think my first like few weeks into the job, and we had this launch date. We had to hit $1 million target before we launched. And I tore my ACL, you know, and I had to go in for surgery. So I went in and I told the CEO, I was like, hey, I'm going to be off for a few weeks. He's like, well, we have this launch date in a month. We have to hit this $1 million target. You're the only person who's selling. And so if you can't do it, then I've got to go find somebody who can. And my healthcare was tied to the job. And, you know, I was like, this is a massive, it was a $60,000 like operation or something like that, because the way that America works. And so I was like, no, I can do it. That's fine. So I like went in for the operation, came out, didn't take any of the medication they told me. And I just like kind of pounded the phones to make the target. So that was my first sort of like cold calling experience. But I think I realized like you can actually get a lot done. I mean, this is probably one of the things that I learned from McKinsey is you can get a lot done in 24 hours. You know, if you don't have I think a lot of us, our focus and priorities get spread so thin. But if you have singular focus and determination, you can get a lot done in a 24-hour period. And you can get a lot done in a month. And so, was able to like pound the phones and learn Excel and hit the target there. But it was definitely my first experience of like, okay, this is how, you know, how startups could go right or wrong. I think ultimately Chamath and the CEO were not on the same page long-term for the vision of the business, and the company ended up sort of imploding. But for me, it was an interesting journey because this was 2010. This was Andreessen Horowitz had just started their venture fund. They were a seed investor in the business. We had a great group of investors, so I met some amazing entrepreneurs and founders. I met the team behind Instagram when they were building a company called Bourbon, and before they pivoted, I met the team behind Slack. When they were still building a game called Tiny Speck, they were all part of that Andreessen portfolio, and it was really interesting for me because those founders that I had read about, right? You read about them in TechCrunch, and you know, you hear them on the podcasts and stuff. I always assumed that they were like on another level than me and my friends that were trying to start businesses in university. And when you meet them, you're like, no, we're all just trying to figure it out. What I realized was being in Silicon Valley and in that network and in that in crowd gave you access to capital and gave you access to prestige and press and then, you know, talent and customers and all the externalities. But there was no reason why founders in, you know, Canada or Europe or India or anywhere else that I had friends and family starting businesses shouldn't have access to that same level of opportunity. And so that was sort of a turning point, I think, in my career of where a theme had always been, how do we take the disproportionate opportunity afforded to Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and sort of expand it globally to unleash, you know, the entrepreneurial creativity that exists in every corner of the world.
So if you check this out, we're going to give you an exact example right now to the audience. So we have Mana Labs at Mana Search. So Mana Search is a fintech search business. And then Mana Labs, we're in collaboration sponsoring research with Imperial College London in their design engineering division. And what are we sponsoring? We're sponsoring referral recruitment technology, Andrew. So, yep. And this is because my whole career, there is literally 50% of the value that we create is through that network of referral. And there is still every tool that ever gets set up and does well. There's a really good one in America at the moment called Drafted. They just get acquired straight away by the bigger recruitment platforms, like let's say LinkedIn, and then quashed. And so if you go look at the application tracking systems at the moment, which has been a big market recently, you've got some really good ones. They all have referral sections within their product somewhere, but rarely are these used. No one's nailed this at all. We're really gonna try our best to nail that. And we think that we've got to, a market fit point in the product life cycle, which is really exciting. Maybe at some point we'll have a conversation. But that is an example of if we'd gone and, you know, met in a sushi bar in Silicon Valley, where suddenly you could have connected me, potentially, if you were so kind, and if you thought I was any level credible enough, with other individuals and things start to mesh and happen. You know, that's why you were in Silicon Valley at that point. And that was a really good point to be there in the history books. Now, what we've seen over the last 18 months is a lot of people from that area distributing around America. And actually, of course, you know, the way to be able to connect globally is just so much easier, just as easy for us to have a Zoom podcast, whereas previously people would have come and physically come into the space. So there's mindset shift. So this is super interesting for you. Sorry, I don't want to finish the bio, but it's such an interesting point because you're now coming to Europe to distribute capital. So you're doing the exact thing that you wanted to do, which is take that Silicon Valley hub and actually, you know, distribute it globally. And I suppose what I'm really interested in is, do you think that therefore the advantages of going to hubs, you know, has just completely gone now, or are there still advantages? What would you advise some of the people that actually you fund, some of the SME owners, to do geographically in this day and age?
Yeah, I think we're in a new world, right, in a new era, and I think it's almost like spend the time, be where you need to be for you to be most effective. And so for some people that's in the countryside of England, right? For some people that's in, you know, South Beach, Miami, right? But be where you need to be effective. Be where you need to be to hire, you know, hire people, but be open to hiring people anywhere. And that's what we're doing. We're realizing that, you know, we're a Toronto company, but we're not limiting our talent to just Toronto. And we're hiring, you know, outstanding talent wherever they sit in the world. But I think this is the opportunity, you know, and this is what we're really aiming to do, is not just unlock capital, but unlock network and advice, you know, targeted introductions to our customers, you know, anywhere, whenever they need them at that right moment. Because I think building an online business, you have to start thinking about it as a global business. And I think that's the real opportunity. If you can find, it may be hard for you to find, you know, to build a big enough business on a niche if you're only looking for customers in London. But if you're looking for customers everywhere in the world, you can have a very, very specific product and be the best in the world of that product. And you can build an incredibly successful and valuable business, you know, on the back of a sort of singular product that meets a specific customer's need, if you know how to find those customers wherever they sit in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what is really crucial is dependent on your business model. Particularly in fintech, you tend to find, you know, you want to go and concentrate in your given market. And often this might be because of regulations. And you do, you know, you need some perspective of patience. Because if you spread yourself too thin, if you try to do everything, like you say, you can just dilute the impact you can have. So of course, you know, going through a list of things that you want to do, crossing a lot off, going, getting great at something, whether that's just, I'm going to make a lot of ED calls today, like you did when you had that operation, then in 24 hours, you can achieve so much. So that's.
I'm sorry, just on that geographic note, one of the interesting things is we found that when you remove the need to meet us in person or even get a warm introduction to us, the geographic diversity of the founders that we back is very different. So in the UK, we fund 70% of our capital goes to founders outside of the London area, which is sort of the opposite of what High Street would have, for example, right? In the US, we funded businesses in every state, and venture capital is really concentrated in four states in the US. And so I think this is one of the interesting things is, if you remove the, so one of the analogies I've had is like, there's a ton of capital, there's a lot of investors looking for return on their capital, right? There's a ton of capital out there. There are a lot of entrepreneurs that are talented, that are trying to build products and solve ambitious, important problems. But the distribution system of capital to people is kind of broken, right? It's very similar, like, we produce a lot of food and a lot of nutrition and calories in the world, and there's a lot of people who need food, but half the world is sort of starving and half the world is overweight, and there's very few people who are like, well, you know, nutritionally complete. And so it's because the distribution system can't get the food to all the people that it needs to, you know, before it spoils or whatever. I think it's very similar in capital. The distribution system of capital is, you know, a number of people who are like Ivy League grads, you know, who are, you know, fun, like taking the capital, producing it, and handing it to a very small number of businesses. So you end up with some, you know, small number of businesses that are overcapitalized, and a large number of founders that are starved for capital and access to opportunity. And so what we're trying to do is use technology to widen that straw, for example, right? And when you don't need a warm introduction to us and you don't need to be able to pitch your business and you can just use the data and your business stands alone, the types of companies that get funded are very different, and the types of products that those founders are building looks very different than maybe the traditional venture capital portfolio.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really exciting to see that movement happening. Just to finish the piece off on bringing you up to the founding of ClearCo or ClearBank at that point. So this, how did this start? If you could tell us the eureka moment, the founding story, ending up at Y Combi.
Yeah. So we, it was really interesting. So I had, coming out of that first experience, I joined a couple of Canadian tech companies, and part of my job was actually to help them. You know, I joined them to lead go to market, but they said, "Hey, because you've spent time in Silicon Valley, can you help us raise money?" And so I sort of learned the game of how to raise venture capital after doing this a couple of times. I was helping sort of, coach and mentor some other entrepreneurs that were going through the same thing. That's how I met my partner, my first girlfriend and now co-founder also, Michelle. She was raising money for her business. And then it was interesting because we had just been dating for probably 4 months. I had joined a company to help them raise money and then build out the go-to-market. It was a hardware, wearable technology company. And we brought in the wrong investors that basically, they gave us a good price, but they took a lot of control in the company. And when we missed a quarter, they sort of said, "All right, we're bringing in our own people now." And they sort of cleaned house. And so after that, I came home, we had just met, just started dating. And I came home and said, I have to go find a new job. And she's like, "Oh, this is great. We're going to start a company." She had just sold her company. And she just got asked to join the cast of Dragon's Den in Canada. And so, Michelle was, she had just, she had bootstrapped all of her previous businesses. She sold her last company. She was now on the show as an investor, and seeing all these entrepreneurs from across the country, pitching their businesses. I had just come out of a career of, venture capital, been burned, seen all the benefits of access to capital, but also been burned by the downsides of giving up too much ownership and control in your business. And so we were both incredibly passionate about entrepreneurship and saw the impact of having more founders and more successful founders in the world as really something that we could, we'd love to be able to work on and empower. And that was where we said, okay, what are we going to start? Do we start another VC? And we sort of looked at each other and said, the world doesn't need another VC. Let's try and use technology to design something different. And so we were using sort of Michelle's Dragon's Den experience and my sort of VC backed experience at Combine and created this business.
And sorry, you're still together now?
Still together. We have not gotten married, not had kids. We basically just have now 300 employees that we take care of. But we're still together and we still run the business together.
Andrew, so I'm going to ask you some questions. That working with your partner has, as I'm sure you've experienced, like some real upside and then some things you need to check. So intentionally, have you guys drawn various lines, or this match just works perfectly? Has it been stressful? What's the upsides for anybody who's either in a relationship where they're working with each other or thinking about doing that? Do you recommend it or not?
I think there's certainly some upsides. One of the great benefits is you actually get to see your partner in their element, right? You get to see what they're really good at. You get to see what you really start to see them as a whole person. A lot of us bring, a big part of our personality to who we are at work and are a different person at home. And sometimes our partners don't get to see. I think during the pandemic, when everybody's been working from home, people have had a glimpse into what their partners do for a living, and it gives them a better perspective on that the person as a whole. So that's been really fun. I think the challenge is obviously, it's hard to turn off, especially as founders of the business. You're constantly talking about things. Michelle and I had very, very different experiences starting the company, which was very complimentary and allowed us to get there. But you know, also has created a lot of friction. We're both very passionate about how we do things and the mission, but have different patterns of how to get there. I've always been venture backed, and it was like, okay, let's go bigger and faster, and we'll figure out the business model later. Michelle's like, no, we've got to focus on profitability and unit economics and make sure that we've got a business that'll be around. And that tension, I think, has led us to build a stronger business. But has also, has certainly caused some healthy debates. And so I think that's one of the things is we've always tried to find ways for us to take, to divide and conquer and say, look, for the things that are operational, for things that are focused on like, how do we deliver what we promised and how do we actually, deliver and execute and make sure that we don't blow up along the way. Michelle really runs point. And then as it starts to think about, what is our product roadmap? How do we think about how big this can be and how quickly, how do we run those experiments without really worrying about, the unit economics? That's the area that I spend more of my time.
Yes. Brilliant advice and crucial that, each partner, and this could probably relate to founders as well, or people within a team, I suppose, have respect for the element that the other individual does and trusts and respects them in that. And like you say, Jen, if you just create various boundaries, which for me is we are not talking about work until we get to work. Like in the evening, that's just going to happen because we're working just till the end of the day. But in the morning, I'll wake up and, my very poor routine where I try and think things through is, having a shower and I'm thinking, okay, how am I going to set my day up? And if someone takes me off that track, I don't find it necessarily productive. And of course, someone else always has a completely different agenda of their given day. So we try and keep that separate. And then once in work, there are different domains anyway. There's a book called, which clearly you guys don't need, but Couples That Work that I've read. And it's really, really good. And it's a set of very prominent professors. And one of them wrote this. And just how they've managed family and their partnership, where they collaborate a lot in business. Oh, well, that's really inspiring. So I think that really kind of like gives us a really good understanding of what the business does, your journey, what makes you tick, and then really just an open forum now, Andrew. If there's anything additional that you wanted to talk about in terms of some of the stuff you're seeing, passionate about right now, or hoping to achieve moving forward?
Yeah, I think that, I think the mission, I've never felt more connected to the mission of the company, especially in this past year. There's been so many businesses that have had to reinvent themselves, go online for the first time, and are trying to figure that out. And I think given sort of our scale and the data that we've seen and what works and what doesn't work, I think we're well positioned and almost obligated to help as many of them as we possibly can. And so our goal here is can we step in? Can we be a partner and a sounding board and value add to help these businesses, beyond just access to capital, right? I think that capital is an important first step. It's like the oxygen. So we need to make sure that they've got, their oxygen mask on, but then we also need to make sure that they can, fly the plane and land the plane, whatever it's not a great analogy, but I think that's how we think about our partnership with our founders is, we can solve the capital problem, but then once you solve the capital problem, immediately you've got this other problem of like, how do I deploy the capital effectively to grow my business? And that's where we're really starting to help, use our data and our recommendations and our network to really help these founders make better decisions and sort of shift the balance of power, right? I think one of the things we tell our team is if you go back 500, 1,000 years, I mean, thousands of years, the people with the money really got to decide what got built, right? Which roads, which castles, which university research projects, whatever get funded. The people who control the money get kind of decide what the future looks like. I think we have an opportunity now to have the people who are facing the problems and really building the solutions and taking the risk actually shape what the future looks like. And we can sort of automate the fact that the money will just flow to them if they're really solving a problem in an innovative and impactful way.
If you're passionate about that, I can only assume you're passionate about blockchain and digital currency and the way that that obviously decentralizes the powers that be. Maybe not with Clicker, or maybe, but are you actively invested in that space?
Yeah, I've been investing in the space for a little while. I mean, I'm not I don't have as much time to spend on it as I would like, but we did, you know, we'd been thinking about our own strategy associated with that, and we do believe that is, you know, there. I don't know if any of the existing protocols in their current format are solving exactly the problem. You know, I think Bitcoin has been a great store of value, and it's an alternative to gold, and that's fantastic. I think Ethereum, you know, in the right incarnation, could give, you know, even AWS a run for its money. And I think there's some really interesting things around distributed computing. I don't know if anybody's really created a cryptocurrency that is, you know, the future global currency. I'm still skeptical of that. I think it'll emerge eventually, but I think there are probably a lot of people who have vested interest in that not happening, and so there will be some struggles on that for sure. But I'm excited about sort of the potential of that future. I just think that the space is sort of currently quite filled with, you know, a lot of chaos and noise, and so I'm trying to pay attention to how it'll impact, you know, people in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the talent that's in that space is immense. So that's one attributing factor to it doing well. The theory and the feel of community is also very powerful, to the point that you spoke about your business and how you're distributing the ability for people to make their own decisions if they're insightful to do it. It's very much the feel in that community, a feel of trust and fairness, which is great. But as you say, yeah, exactly. I think really, I mean, a lot of people are kind of having a joke about NFTs right now. But I think what we're seeing with that is possibly the first large user case example where via gas fees on Ethereum, if you want to, you know, you have the ability to purchase a digital asset. And so I think we'll start seeing other user cases, whether it's on Ethereum or Polkadot or whichever one, Cardano, people prefer. Like you say, is the Google or Amazon of distributed finance well known yet? Maybe, maybe not. But definitely over the next 10 years, we'll keep an eye on it. And conceptually, I'm definitely long on it as well. Just to finish off, Andrew, you've been very kind with your time. Really appreciate that. We always ask, given the show's called Searching for Mana, which you knew exactly what Mana was, which is great. What would you say, you know, throughout your career or now, your Mana is?
Yeah, I think... This is a good question. So I love making sort of connections, maybe non-obvious connections with people. I think I get this from my mom. My mom will talk to everybody in a grocery store and she'll remember that, like, you know, this person that she met 4 years ago loved a certain type of flower and will send them a photo of it and things like that. She just sort of has these things that I don't think you could ever program into an AI to make these sort of connections. And I think I've inherited a little bit of that. What I love doing, you know, in that now in my role is putting people in a role to succeed. So I'll find somebody who's, you know, we had someone who was working incredibly hard, really passionate about the mission in sales. And, you know, she was doing a great job, but was not really, you know, wasn't really satisfied in the sales role and moved her into a, you know, talent recruitment role and has completely sort of blossomed and done an awesome job. And so, those kind of things, just putting people in the right role for them to succeed, has been something that, you know, I've always been incredibly energized by and love doing.
It's such a rewarding thing, isn't it? It's you know, whether this sounds good anymore or not. You know, I was definitely told early on in headhunting, you know, the most important thing about a captain is putting the person into the right position on the ship, right, as some type of ridiculous old metaphor or whatever it is. But it's so true, like, that's the job, right? And so if you take pleasure from that, and it is incredibly rewarding, and if you're good at that, then that's a fantastic honor to have, and one that sounds like you're fortunate to pick up and learn from your mother.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's been a fun journey.
And I know that she's annoyed that you're not at McKinsey, but certainly, sorry, what's her name?
Yvette,
if you're listening, Andrew's done okay. And I feel like he's earned the right to eat the croissant.
That's right. Exactly.
Andrew, thank you so much for coming onto the show. Absolute pleasure. And I wish you all the success moving forward.
Thanks so much, Lloyd. Appreciate it very much.